Linda, this is a continuation of a discussion with F.D. Gossage, Production Coordinator for the Common Glory, Williamsburg, Virginia, June 28, 1966. Sam, in other areas, we have found the audience at times may be tenacious about staying during a rainy period, particularly if there are groups or persons coming either by bus or by car from very long distances who will have only this opportunity probably to see the play. I know at Harrodsburg, sometimes they were willing to wait or even insisted if the company, if there were enough of them, on waiting longer than an hour. Now, do you have any policy that would say cut the show off if it rained over 30 minutes or over 40 minutes or over an hour, or again, is it purely a matter of judging the specific audience?
I think it's each individual case is trying to attempt to solve.
Who has the responsibility for calling a rain interruption? Is it the director or the play?
The stage manager is responsible for stopping the performance. The general manager or the production manager may cancel the show.
Now you're speaking of before the performance starts.
Before the performance starts or after the performance starts.
Oh, I see. The responsibility then is with the front of the house to determine this on the basis of the audience.
The stage manager can stop the show when, because quite often the production manager, the general manager, are not backstage or in the auditorium. We may be here at the office or here in the parking lot when the rain starts. This makes us a quarter of a mile or so from the auditorium, so the stage manager may stop the show so that the audience and the actors can find shelter somewhere, but the responsibility for canceling the evening performance rests with the front of the house.
Now, I have one follow-up question here. In handling the audience, you mentioned six ushers. Do you use special people who are just ushers, or do certain members of the company who appear later in the show double in this category? What use do you make of the people here?
We have in the past sent some ushers back to appear in crowd scenes during the second act of the show, in the battle and things like this. We're not doing that this year. The ushers seat people during the show, sell our concessions during intermission, and then assist in the parking lot after the show. So none of our ushers appear on stage.
Now, Sam, are there any other points that you think we ought to cover in terms of the general procedures of handling the audience, such standard things as the seating and the methods of the ushers? I don't think we need to go into, but just what is on your mind now that presents a different situation outdoors over the indoor situation?
Well, I think other than the things we've talked about, the operation is pretty much like an indoor theater, something we might call regular or standard.
Linda, we've been talking to Forrest Donald Gossage, production manager for The Common Glory. That's the end of this interview. I'll be back with you in a minute. Linda, this interview is with Mr. Robert Andrews, who is the production stage manager for The Common Glory, Williamsburg, Virginia, tape recorded June 28, 1966. I would like to ask you, Bob, first, what the major differences in terms of problems to be faced that you find in an outdoor production that are, well, vastly different from the indoor ones. We may talk a little bit about disadvantages, then we'll talk a little bit about advantages of outdoor production. First, of course, the obvious thing is you have more space to control in terms of the playing area than most indoor stages. At the same time, you have a far greater number of people, it would appear from viewing the show, than most indoor shows would have. I'm sure that these present some problems to you, and suppose you just, if you would, give us your impressions on these two points.
Well, I think that they could become problems, but I think if you... I think the basic thing that you have to bring out before the show ever opens, and the director of the Commodore, Mr. Scammon, and myself agreed prior to the opening of the show that he would give a little talk at the opening of rehearsals, laying down the rules. And I think that although you're right, there is a difference, especially in the size of the cast, that it doesn't become a problem unless you let it become a problem. And if the rules are set down and are followed regardless of friendships or any other factor which might be involved, and exceptions are never made, I don't think it ever becomes a problem. It's just this is a rule. If it's broken, then the consequences follow.
Well, these rules you mentioned, are they established to assist in handling the traffic? I'm sure you must have a traffic control problem like a busy intersection at times. In addition to yourself as stage manager, do you have assistants who help to control the backstage traffic?
Well, this is left really informal. I think the spirit is so good in the Glory this year that everybody pitches in, and if you've got a problem, I know especially on the technical crew, a lot of them are self-appointed helpers, and not in the sense of being officious, but in the sense of really being helpful. And if there is a problem of congestion, they clear it up, if I'm not around.
Well, essentially, you have turned, what you're saying is that you have turned the responsibility for a good part of this up to the performer himself. May I ask you another
mm-hmm.
question now? Do the young performers, basically here from colleges, some perhaps from professional school and some a little more experienced, but basically from colleges, do they come to you with an attitude of professional discipline and cooperation in such matters backstage? Or is this something that you and Mr. Scammon have to work to achieve at the beginning of rehearsals?
Well, that's my answer would have to be mixed to that. I think that the first couple of days, if we were to have a cast which is totally new, we would have a definite problem. But we have, at least this year and in years past to an extent, a number of people who've been in the show before, and they set the pace. And I think by example, more than anything else, they take this problem out of our hands, that the young people who are coming to us for the first time see that this is the way the show is done, and this is the way the people will act, and if they have problems, then they come to me before it reaches the critical stage. And I think although that at the beginning, no, they don't come with a professional attitude, that they pick it up quickly.
Is that something that they should get in school and don't? I know that's a leading question. Or is it just the matter that they are young people? If you have an opinion, fine. If you don't, why, that's...
I think it's a combination of both. I think to an extent, yes, it should be taught in school. I know I went to William & Mary, where Mr. Scammon is the head of the theater department, and I had it. And I think it should be taught everywhere, but it's not.
And your cast, of course, comes from many different areas, not just
right.
from this
right.
Particular training ground.
That's true.
Bob, in arranging the scene shifts, I understood that you use a number of the cast members as grips,
mm-hmm.
that you don't carry a separate large stage crew to do the shifting and so forth.
No, that's
now,
right.
In terms of shifting properties and shifting scenery both, this means a rather specific detailing of jobs, doesn't it, to make sure that
it
works. Could you give us some idea of how you go about setting that up?
Well, this is one of the parts of the show that you can't plan beforehand too greatly, because you don't really know who's going to show up on opening day. There's always a chance, and we had a couple of them this year. And for some reason or other, these people who had planned to be with us couldn't make it. So you've basically left with the problem of, as early as possible, assigning the specific changes to the specific actors or people in the choir. We're lucky that we have a number of people in the choir who really don't do much else except act as supers in the large scenes. And to them, really, is delegated most of the scene changes. And these are made just as when we see that someone is free and a change must be made, then we assign it. And it's done rather haphazardly, but I don't see any other way that it could
be. Well, you
done.
Say it's done haphazardly. You don't mean the changes in the show. They certainly went smooth enough last
night. Oh, right.
You mean the arrangement of
right.
it. I wanted to,
right.
to
yeah.
make that clear that it's the assignment that is haphazard until rehearsals
That's
are underway, and then it's frozen.
What I meant to say is that there's no formula for assigning the changes. They're assigned as the opening and the necessity is seen. But once they've been assigned, right, they flow smoothly.
I would like to ask you, too, since a large part of the scene shifting is done in the dark and near dark backstage, as to whether you have special precautions for safety. Obviously, I walked around backstage and I noticed that smoking is allowed only in certain areas, partly because the smoke would get on stage and probably for safety factors. You have a number in the production, a number of explosive effects used, and you have gunshots and so on, where someone might get burned. But in addition to that, what particular precautions do you take, either by regulation or by other controls backstage, to ensure the safety of the people in these big group scenes when they're coming in and going off?
Well, the primary one is the one that you mentioned about the gunpowder. And this, again, is set out opening night, and one of the rules is that you do not smoke in the prop shop, which for the explosives in our show is at stage left. And there are certainly enough signs that if you didn't pick it up when it was given, you know enough not to smoke there. It's a specific area in which you do not smoke. And also, you mentioned that there's no smoking because of smoke coming up and being picked up by the lights on stage. Another precaution that is not apparent at first is the fact that in the large scenes where you have people carrying guns, and although these many of them don't fire, they're still pretty dangerous when you go swinging them about in the air. And you've got, at the end of one of these large scenes, you have an instant blackout, and the actors are plunged from, you know, the bright lights into complete darkness, and they have to have specific routes by which to leave the stage, or someone is going to get trampled or hit with one of these guns on the exit. So they, one of the things that the director has to assign, in addition to everything else that his job entails, is the assigning of specific routes for each actor off stage, and he's got to follow that, or an injury will result.
Do you use safety lights to indicate these exits, shielded lights, or do you use an assistant who uses a mask flashlight to light people off? What's done about this?
This is, I think, one of the most valuable tools that we have backstage is the flashlight, and this is basically what we use. There are a few boys in the show who just work on props, and then at the end of the big crowd scenes, they're standing in the wings with the mask flashlight. This is our safety precaution there.
Bob, one of the things we're trying to determine in this survey are suggestions for improved training of the young actors and technicians and stage managers who are coming along the way. Do you have any comment of things that you think from your experience? You mentioned you went to college at William and Mary. Are there things in your observation of the people from a variety of schools that you have in the cast that you would like to comment on, any suggestions of things that you think are missing in terms, we've talked about the attitude of self-discipline and artistic discipline and approaching the job in the beginning. Are there any other that you would like to add?
Well, not really. I think that that covers such a broad area that I think this is the basic problem, that you can't expect a director to, I mean, to an extent this is educational theater, but the actor coming here has to have a certain amount of self-discipline, and I think this is our biggest problem, because they don't realize that, or they don't realize fully enough, I guess, that this is a business, first and foremost. The people have put down good money to see the show, and they deserve to see a good show, a well-run show, and not to see some crazy college punk fooling around on stage. And this is our biggest problem with docking, and although we haven't had anything of that nature this year.
Docking, you mean docking pay?
Right.
You have penalties for infringements of the rules?
That's right.
Could you give us an idea of how this works before we close off the tape? I think this is an important point, and it's not been mentioned in any of the other interviews.
Well, the way we work it is, again, I say, Mr. Scanlon and I set down the rules at opening of rehearsals as to how a scene is going to be played, and any deviation from the... I guess the judgment is left up to myself as to whether a material deviation has been made from the way the scene should be played. And if, in my judgment, this is so, then the actor receives the night's, is docked the night's salary. We also have dockings for signing up on the sign-in sheet for company call late and for any other material infringement.
I know this system is followed at Harrodsburg, or was, and at the Lost Colony, and at Under These Hills, but this is, you're the first one to put this on the tape and into the record for us, and I appreciate that. Linda, we've been talking to Robert Andrews, the production stage manager for The Common Glory, Williamsburg, Virginia, and I'll be back with you in a little bit. Linda, I'm talking to Albert Hack, technical director of The Common Glory. Albert Hock, technical director of The Common Glory in Williamsburg, Virginia, June 28, 1966. Al, the first question I have this morning is concerned with differences in indoor and outdoor staging, and I would like to ask first, what do you find to be the greatest disadvantage of outdoor staging?
The greatest disadvantage is the fact, of course, that you're outdoors and you have weather to contend with, and where you can use various types of paint, for instance, on in the indoor. Outdoor paint, I know we've gone to Lucite paint, and if you want any dark shades, you just can't get them in flat paint. And this wouldn't make any difference indoors, because you could use various types of binders and get the paint you want. But we found that the Lucite paint stands up as well as any oil paint that you can get, except that you have trouble getting the darker color. I know when we were painting the ships this year, we wanted a dark gray. Well, the Oxford gray is about dark as you can get, and they make the Lucite paint a flat paint for outdoor, for houses, and you can use that. But then when you go to the trim colors, they're all enamels. You see trim and porch, a deck enamel, and that gets to be a problem. But the solution, I think, not solution, but the difference is that you also have to, all your plywood, of course, has to be marine type, water resistant or waterproof plywood. And we found that the best to use down here, and still the cheapest, is the forming plywood that the construction people use, that's oil treated. And so all the plywood we have down here and the platforms and everything else is that oil-treated exterior plywood that they use for concrete forming. And it's much less expensive than regular marine plywood, and yet it stands up quite almost.
I notice, in speaking of differences here, I notice that you have a number of plastic or three-dimensional units, some on rollers, and well, I guess maybe they're mostly on rollers, or platforms, wagons of one kind or another. Can you use the same technique of constructing three-dimensional units that you can use indoors? Do you go in outdoors for fiberglass or any more sophisticated production materials than you might use indoors?
Well, here again, in the basic construction of a wagon or a platform, we found that the weather, again, is a factor, and so we've gone to steel framing, and everything we have down here now is framed in steel and then covered with plywood, so that the casters, instead of being mounted in wood, or like in a wood 2x6 or 2x4, is welded right to the steel frame, and then that frame is covered with plywood, and the plywood, again, is covered with tar paper, and then canvas over that. In order to lick that weather problem. And also I know in the Founders, and of course here, where you have a double wagon, for instance in the, well let's take the Philly unit, and the other side is the Palace. And each one of them has a wing to simulate a sort of a background with a wing coming off, you know, or a twofold or threefold, and that would, when you look at the thing in plan, that wagon in plan, it has a long narrow center, which are the two walls front and back, and then there's a wing coming up from each side, so it makes a reverse double arrow type thing, you know, and it's very difficult to construct out of wood and have it stay together, because there's no way of joining wood, whereas steel, when you run it out at an angle and weld it, you have the angle and it stays there. And so that's the way that one's constructed too. And then the farmhouse unit is another oddball shape, as far as that, because it's a long wall with the one window coming out at an angle. And you couldn't do that in wood. We found that the first set of scenery that we had these huge rectangular wagons that were about 11 feet high, and they were one end and one side covered with hedging that Operation Shmoo had a long time ago, with the hardware cloth and the waterproof linoleum paste and Excelsior, and then painted to make it look like hedge. And then the other side was hard surface, which we used oil-tempered masonite. And we found that the joints, they were all put together with made out of 2x6s, and they had a steel plate to mount the caster in, and that in turn was bolted to the wood. But the wagons fell apart because over a period of years water would get down. You had dry rot occurring in these structural members holding the whole thing together, and so we just went to steel.
Do you take particular efforts to shield the scenery from the weather between performances? I know you do over the winter, of course, but...
Well, the only thing that, anything that you can run in the shop, you do. But all the large wagons and the Philly unit, the jail unit, the jail wall goes inside. The jail unit itself is right out to the weather all the time. And all the, as I say, the platforms, we don't worry about those because they are covered with tar paper and canvas and then painted on top of it. And the plywood itself is oil treated so that it'll stay there as long as the steel practically. As long as it doesn't have to hold anything, it's just covering. You see all the...
Go ahead.
I'm talking about odd shapes. When we did the Founders, we had huge... See, that was supposed to move at one time. And so when we redid it for the Common Glory stage, it had this huge church unit and warehouse And we have some, or well, they're rectangular on one end, and we talk about odd-shaped platform. It's a triangular or acute angle on one side, you know, and a long, narrow type thing. And you see all those frames in the woods there now. They're just sitting there. But we've got to salvage the casters and cut the frames up somehow. But I bet there's several thousand dollars worth of steel up there.
Do you well, I know you use many cast members to assist with the scene shifting. Do you find these units are considerably heavier? I noticed now one thing, that most of your wagons moved silently last night for all practical purposes. And in some cases, I've heard some very noisy wagons, possibly because of the looseness of wood construction that was beginning to separate.
That could be it. No, any noise that we pick up here is because of irregularities in the floor. It's difficult to get a perfectly smooth floor, and of course this one has been down here and has been worked on in patch, but we definitely need some resurfacing, and we've been scratching our heads trying to figure out what we can put on that stage that will give us a smooth surface both for the dancers and also for the scenery. But in the first few years when that cement was
fresh and
fresh
poured, yeah,
you could change a scene and you'd never hear anything.
I know we were building some side stages for production in Kentucky, and we used a transit to set the surface of the concrete. Lined it up by transit was the only way. We figured we couldn't have more than a quarter of an inch tolerance. We had a lot of hinged rolling units that had to fit on that. And apparently, of course, the stage surface has been a big problem for everybody. One of the best in terms of killing the sound of multitudes of feet marching back and forth has been sand. This is not a good jump off for dancers. It also is a little bit slippery. But at the same time, the dancers find a damp concrete stage simply murder, and of course on any kind of concrete it's very rough on the legs. But in the meantime, you can't roll scenery across sand. So
no, now you put
this,
sand.
This becomes
now
something.
All you have to do is put a little sand on the concrete, though, and then you have the noise right there too. Especially in shifting, I notice it when you have some person that's backing a unit off stage, and there's a tendency to drag the foot, of course, and as soon as you have a little sand on top of the cement or concrete, then you have a noise. But the resurfacing gets to be a real problem, because if you had to tear up that entire stage area and redo it, it would be a tremendous expense. See, there's about a 6-inch slab of concrete down there. And so we've been trying to work out something that we can put that on top of it. And also the tormentor pipes go right through that concrete and are anchored in the, about 2.5 feet of a wall underneath the slab that's there, you see. So we went right through the slab after that windstorm we had in 57, when we lost all the temporary tormentors we used to put down there. That's when I anchored the steel frames down there. And we use a 1/4 inch or 3/8 inch plywood that's covered with this velveteen that's treated for water.
For weather.
Mm-hmm. And a covering, now we recovered this year, and it lasts, we had about 4 seasons out of that velveteen.
It's a very good light absorber.
It is. You can't paint a surface
one of the things
anywhere near as
black. One of the things that I see, we're running out of tape over here in a few moments now. We'd better keep an eye on that and give Linda a cue that we're going to move to a fresh tape. One of the things that I liked about this show was the fact that you have absorbed the light in many cases using suggested scenery. Well, of course, that's a matter of design, but technically, you have absorbed the light, so that there are times when we see nothing but the actors and the space with no consciousness of anything other than a suggested scenery. It really works. We always try this indoors, and it doesn't work. Well, but here it works.
Actually, what I would like to see down here, but we didn't get to it this year, and that is in the opening scene, for instance, the Dunmore seal is up against that serpentine wall, and if that were covered in black, it would be better.
Yes.
And also on the side stages, the backing for the side stages. Now those are painted black.
Well, now they do kick a little light. They do kick a little light.
But it would be better if that were done in blue too. Getting back to the noise and the casters, in 48 when we built, or 47 started with the first wagons. We discovered and make a definite caster that we have a half number, you know, on a trade number, this Darnell caster, because the industrial casters, they don't worry about the what we call clucking in the ball bearing joint, and so we get ours, and it has a round rubber tires, a 6-inch wheel or 5.5-inch wheel, and they also make especially run them through especially so that they get a tight joint, so you do not get any clucking. That's what also will make noise on the outdoor stage. And because in an industrial way the casters are ordinarily used, the noise doesn't make any difference, but on stage it does.
You've got some special scenery effects, but we're going to have to wait till we get to the next tape to talk about that, Al. Linda, we go from here to tape 3.